Okay, we are now starting a second series on the search for truth. And in the second series, we're going to be looking at natural theology. But what I thought we should do before beginning is to look at very briefly what we did in the last series. So if anybody is listening to these recordings, or if you've not listened to our previous study that we did, we looked at a work I did called Weltanschauung, which was a survey of worldviews. And so in this epilogue here, I'm basically giving you a summary of what we did in this search. And your questions right now are highly welcome once we go through this survey, because I can clarify some things, some missing pieces that you might have in your minds as to sort of how we came to these conclusions. But just to go ahead and start off, we started our search for truth sort of where you should start off. And what I mean by that is we started with the whole issue of knowledge. How do you know what you know? And I pointed out that knowledge is justified true belief. To have knowledge is to have a positive cognitive attitude towards this given proposition. That proposition must be true. It must correspond to reality. And then finally, you have to have justification or some sort of warrant or evidence that supports what it is that you claim to know. And without those three components, there is no knowledge. Well, we went on to talk about how do you justify your knowledge claims, and we argue that you justify them through what is called foundationalism, which means that you start with basic beliefs. You have a basic belief that's here. And a basic belief would be a first principle of rationality. What would be a first principle of rationality? Things like the law of contradiction or the law of non-contradiction, which says the two contradictions can't both be true, or two contradictory propositions or contradictions or properties, propositions that contradict each other cannot both be true at the same time and in the same sense. So that's the law of contradiction. We have the law of identity, which is says that something is itself. We have the law of excluded middle, which says that between contradictory propositions, there is no third option. We also have the principle of existence, something is. Does anyone here deny that something exists? Do any of you that exist deny that something exists? Stupid joke. And then we have the law of causality, which basically says that whatever begins to exist has to have a cause. If something begins to be, there must be some explanation for it. We also have a basic belief called the principle of credulity. The principle of credulity says that we just trust our senses unless we have really good reason to say otherwise. Now, these basic principles, these first principles of rationality, are at the basic, the bottom line of your beliefs. And then you build your knowledge scheme on top of that. The things that you that are directly inferred from these basic beliefs, you hold closer, and then you build your understanding of the world on top of that. That's called foundationalism. In foundationalism, you reason from the known to either the unknown or the not as well known, right? And this is just how we work. This is how we function as knowers. Sometimes things at the top of this pyramid are thought to be true but aren't, and when you find out that you're wrong, you remove that part of the pyramid, right? Okay? So that's foundationalism. This is how we structure our knowledge claims. We build on what we know. What we failed to come up with, however, is an adequate source of knowledge. Where does knowledge come from? And we looked at mysticism, we looked at empiricism, and we looked at rationalism, and we concluded these are not adequate sources of knowledge. And so we went on the search for a worldview that can give us the preconditions of knowing, that can actually serve as the adequate source of knowledge. And that led us to the next chapter, which was chapter 2, and we did a survey, a very quick survey of worldviews, and we realized that there are only 6 worldviews the humans have ever entertained. Agnosticism, polytheism, pantheism, panentheism, theism, and atheism. And then we analyzed those worldviews with a test for truth. And we came up with a certain test for truth, and that test is called incontrovertibilism. I made up the word. Incontrovertibilism is the test for truth, which basically says 2 things. It has a test for falsity, and it has a test for truth. The test for falsity says that if you come across a worldview that is self-defeating, it literally slits its own throat, it pulls the rug out from under itself on its own terms, then that worldview must be false. So if a worldview is self-defeating, it must be false. Examples of self-defeating propositions: I do not exist. That's a self-defeating proposition. The law of contradiction isn't true. That's sorry for the technical difficulty, but we're back on track. Incontrovertibilism, there's a truth for falsity. There's a truth for falsity. There's a test for falsity and a test for truth. As I just said, if a worldview is self-defeating, and examples of self-defeating propositions would be, I don't exist, or I can't speak a word in English while I'm saying the words in English, or the law of contradiction is not true, all of those are self-defeating propositions. If you have a worldview that has that, then that worldview must be false. There's another test for falsity called insufficiency. If you have a worldview that has to piggyback on another worldview for it to be true, then that worldview isn't false. And I'm about to illustrate what that means in just a minute. But if you have a worldview that can only be true if another worldview is true, then that worldview is irrelevant. It's an insufficient worldview. It doesn't matter. Truth, if you come across a worldview that is literally undeniable, then that worldview must be true. And there are 3 ways to establish undeniability. One is transcendentally, and we're going to talk about transcendental arguments in a minute. Another way is analytically, and another way is existentially. And so in the course of natural theology, I'm actually going to show how theism is transcendentally undeniable, existentially undeniable, and analytically undeniable. But just to give you an informal presentation of a transcendental argument, presuppose, that is, presuppose anything, but in this case we'll say presuppose the law of non-contradiction, or that the law of non-contradiction or contradiction is false. Presuppose either one. The law of contradiction is true. That's how a transcendental argument works. Because even when you say to me that the law of contradiction is not true, you have to use the law of non-contradiction to make that statement. Does that make sense to all of you? So if I say contradictions can't both be true, and you raise your hand and you say, I disagree, you can only say that if the law of non-contradiction is true. And so it is transcendentally undeniable. It is a precondition for knowing anything whatsoever. And you can't even refute the law of non-contradiction without using the law of non-contradiction. Does that make sense? Now, what we did in Weltanschauung is we actually showed that God is the transcendental. You can't argue against God without presupposing God. So God is just as transcendentally necessary as the law of non-contradiction, even more so. So, moving on, what I do on page 302 is I kind of walk you through very quickly how these worldviews are, in fact, false. So I pointed out that agnosticism is false. The strong claim that no one can know God is self-defeating, for to say that God is unknowable is a knowledge claim. And to insist that God is unknowable is to claim a universal comprehension of every fact. For how does one know that God is unknowable? In other words, one can only be a consistent agnostic if one is God, which is self-defeating. Weak agnosticism is not self-defeating, but it is insufficient as a worldview. No one is a mere agnostic. Any agnostic is someone with a distinct view of ultimate reality, and so every agnostic is either an agnostic polytheist, or an agnostic pantheist, or an agnostic panentheist, or an agnostic theist, and those are called fideists. A fideist is someone who says you just have to believe that there's a God, you can't prove God. And then finally, there's an agnostic atheist. So agnosticism is either self-defeating or insufficient. Does that make sense to all of you? Polytheism is not a self-defeating worldview. Saying Zeus exists is not self-defeating, but polytheism is an insufficient worldview. Even if you prove to my satisfaction that the gods exist, you've not explained where they come from. You've not given me their origin. You've not told me everything about them. And it turns out that according to polytheism, the gods do come from a universe, the universe that we live in. They are products of this universe just like you and me. Well, what is the nature of the universe that the gods come from? And your options are, it is either a pantheistic universe, in which the case the gods are just modes of the one God. It is a panentheistic universe, in which the universe is just codependent upon God. It is an atheistic universe, in which case the gods are just evolved creatures. Or it's a theistic universe, in which the gods are creatures of God. Kind of like angels. So polytheism is false. Pantheism is false. Pantheism is the belief that everything is God, including you. But the claim that all is God is self-defeating because you ask the pantheist the following question. The world that I live in isn't unchanging and one and necessary like God is. See, pantheists believe that God is absolutely one, that God is absolutely necessary, that God is absolutely unchanging. And yet, when I look out into the world, I notice that the world isn't those things. The world is diverse and changing and temporal. So, at that point, the pantheist will say, the problem here is that all is Maya. Everything around us is Maya. It's all an illusion. So, Mr. Pantheist, all is an illusion. Yes. What about my thoughts? My rational thoughts are changing. They change from time to time. I change my mind, and so on. And the pantheist says, all of your thoughts are an illusion too. They're all Maya. Okay, well then take the statement, pantheism is true. Is it Maya? If the pantheist says yes, then pantheism is itself an illusion. The thought that you are God is an illusion. Therefore, pantheism is self-defeating. If the pantheist says, no, that one thought is not illusory, well, then our thoughts are not illusory. We can actually get at the real world. Another way to put it is this. Mr. Pantheist, when did you come to know that pantheism is true? When he says, I came to know that pantheism is true at this point, he's admitted that there's change in his mind, in his consciousness, in which case he is changing. And therefore, he is not God. So what is the great disproof of pantheism? That pantheists write books. I mean, if I'm God, I don't need another pantheist to tell me. And apparently, pantheists have to convince others, including themselves, that they are God. Moving on to panentheism. Panentheism is false. Panentheism says that it is just as true to say that God caused the world to be as it is to say that the world causes God to be. And so what the panentheist actually believes in is a self-caused loop where you have God here and the world here, and the world causes God and God causes the world. That is a self-caused system of effects. You see how self-defeating that is? You can't need a cause only to be the cause you need. That's a contradiction. You can't exist before you exist. And therefore, you cannot be self-caused. And therefore, panentheism is a false view of reality. Atheism is false. On page 303, I point out that atheism is impossible, for the atheist insists that everything that is the result of chance, which entails that the brain is the result of chance, which entails that we must doubt our cognitive faculties, which also entails that we have to doubt atheism, because atheism is a product of those cognitive faculties. And finally, the other last of the non-theistic worldviews, there's a view called pagan theism. And so we actually ended up splitting pagan theism from Abrahamic theism, because they're distinct. You'll notice I misnumbered there, but that's irrelevant. The point is there are two kinds of pagan theisms, pure and mixed. Plato and Aristotle are examples of the former. Iskon and Rastafarianism are examples of the latter. Pure paganisms attempt to construct a worldview advocating the existence of one transcendent God upon reason alone, with no recourse to divine revelation. We have seen them all fail, since all of them lead to more than a few inconsistent doctrines. For example, Plato's world of forms falls prey to the argument of the third man. Aristotle's theory of abstraction is absurd. Mixed paganisms are either historically, like Sikhism, or doctrinally, like Baha'i, tied to the Judeo-Christian Islamic scriptures, or both. Many of these paganisms will start off with a proclamation that they are being biblical, only to later repudiate the Bible. Even worse, the doctrines of these religions cannot withstand an internal critique. And so in Weltanschauung, we showed that internal critique, and we showed that those views of God cannot be true. Abrahamic theism alone is true. Even when we give the non-theist the benefit of the doubt, going so far as to allow him to set up the debate in a way that favors his perspective, for example, by granting that the theist alone has the burden of proof and that theism is highly improbable, we find that intellectual honesty forces us to grant that the Abrahamic God is at least a possibly existing being. In other words, Abrahamic theism is not a self-defeating worldview, nor is it insufficient, since it offers a truly comprehensive view of reality. Such cannot be said of any other worldview we have considered. We establish our claim even while granting the major conclusion of all anti-theistic worldviews, namely, theism is probably false. Indeed, once one eliminates the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, has to be the truth. Theism, though improbable, is the only worldview that is possibly true, therefore theism is true. However, Abrahamic theism is actually not improbable, for we have seen that even the inductive arguments against it fail, and besides, such arguments beg the question insofar as they presuppose the falsity of theism. And furthermore, we saw that the transcendental argument shows that the God of Abrahamic theism is the necessary precondition of human rationality, and thus anything which demonstrates the humanness of humanity. So God is the necessary precondition for doing science or history or math or what have you. And so our conclusion is basically that all of the worldviews that compete with Abrahamic theism are false, and that Abrahamic theism alone is transcendentally undeniable. It's true because of the impossibility of the contradictory. Anything that contradicts theism is false. And those things are false because it turns out that in order to argue against God, you must presuppose God while you're doing your arguing. Now, before I take another step, do you guys have a question or anything you want to ask about the nature of this whole discussion?
When you were on the internet, internet.
Yes.
And you come across people who give these arguments, which one are you most likely to encounter?
When I come across these arguments?
Yes.
Arguments in favor of atheism or whatever? Oh, on the internet, I think skepticism is the most common view you come across. There's a growing number of young people who are just saying all of this is bunk. You know, and all by all of this, they mean all the religions of the world are just stupid. And so they would actually track with me all the way till we get to the end. Because the way I set it up is we looked at atheism last. And so I actually established, you know, as we went through it, we established the improbability of theism. And I didn't give Nathan, I don't give the students any relief there. And, you know, usually when I'm teaching this class, I'll have a student come up to me, and I'm teaching, you know, a group, a mixed audience, a group of unbelievers. And some of them are believers, some of them are unbelievers. But two or three of my students each semester will come up to me after we look at agnosticism, and they realize that strong agnosticism is self-defeating and weak agnosticism is insufficient. They get that. And they, in fact, I quote atheistic writers who actually debunk this idea that agnosticism is the third alternative. And they say, I'm an agnostic atheist. And I say, okay, interesting. You just gave me a bit of interesting autobiography there. And I think that that's really where most skeptics are going. People that tend to want to share their views about God and that don't believe in God, they are skeptics. And so you watch Bart Ehrman address the Freedom From Religion Foundation. A few years ago, Bart Ehrman spoke to them, and he asked two questions. First, is there a God? And he goes, how the hell should I know? I don't know. Well, he goes, in that sense, I'm an agnostic. And then he said, do I believe that there is a God? He said, no, I don't believe that there's a God because I don't think there's any evidence for God. So what is he? He's an agnostic atheist. He doesn't think you can answer the question, but he also doesn't think there is a God. Now, are there agnostic theists? Yeah, I dare say that there are people in our church who just don't think that you can prove any of these things. Hopefully my Sunday school classes nudge them in a certain direction. But Karl Barth would be a really good example of an agnostic theist. He was a fideist. He just didn't think he could know, but he believed in God anyway. Okay. But yeah, the most common objections come from the skeptical community. Anybody else have a question? Nothing? All right. Well, then let's move forward on page 305. Here's the question, the two questions. What exactly have we proved, and what remains to be proved? Those are the two questions that we want to ask and answer. The answer to the former question is that we have proved most, if not all, the core doctrines Abrahamic theists have in common. At the very least, we have demonstrated that an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good God exists who created human beings in his image and has in some sense revealed himself in Scripture. Now that's a lot. We've proved that. We know God exists because he is the precondition of knowledge, and we know that humans possess the divine image because if God were wholly unlike us, it would be impossible for us to know him, but we do know him. Therefore, God is not wholly unlike us. We did not make him, for he exists, but he made us. Therefore, he made us to be somewhat like him. And that just is the essence of the doctrine of the Imago Dei, the idea that God created us in his image. We know that God has revealed himself in Scripture because no other culture has come to a knowledge of the Abrahamic God except those that have been influenced by the Abrahamic Scriptures. Now, that is a point that needs to be developed more, obviously. But that is an important point. So what we have is a kind of, if you will, trifecta. We have the worldview called Abrahamic theism. And there are three planks for it. Scripture, God, and the Imago Dei, the image of God. These are the three main planks that we've established. Do y'all see that? And it turns out that you really can't have one without the other. If you had the you can't have the Imago Dei without God, and you can't have a revelation in Scripture without God. But you can't have a knowledge of God without Scripture and the Imago Dei either. Does that make sense to all of you? Okay, so that's what we've established. Which scriptures, and this is the key here. This is the next question. This is the next question we have to ask. Which scriptures exactly have been vindicated by our argument? Is it the Hebrew scriptures, the Tanakh, the Old Testament, the Greek scriptures, or the New Testament, or the Quran? Which one of those have we established? We know that God has revealed at least some truths within the pages of the Hebrew scriptures. That is to say, the Hebrew scriptures at least contain a word from God. We know that, even if they are not wholly inspired by God. We know this, first of all, because we know that Abrahamic theism is true, but no one can be an Abrahamic theist without being either a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim. For these three religious expressions of Abrahamic theism exhaust what an Abrahamic theist can be. So we've narrowed our search for truth down to Abrahamic theism, and that gives us three religious alternatives or three possibilities: Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Secondly, we have already established that God himself had something to do with the production of Abrahamic scriptures, since only those who have read or heard these scriptures know the God we're talking about. Furthermore, it is only in the scriptures where we read of humankind's being made in the image of of God, and so the scriptures alone guarantee the knowledge of God. Finally, we know that at least the Hebrew scriptures have been revealed by God, at least in part, for A, the Quran itself insists that God has revealed himself within the pages of the Bible. So if you become a Muslim, you have to grant that the Hebrew Bible is inspired. And also the New Testament says on a number of occasions that the Hebrew scriptures were inspired. This does not, of course, rule out the possibility that the New Testament is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. That's what the Christians believe. Nor does it rule out the possibility that the Quran corrects the corruption of the Bible given by Jews and Christians. So that's what Muslims think. They think that you Christians and Jews corrupted the revelation of God, and so the Quran had to come along as the final revelation to correct it. Now, that possibility still remains. What all of this establishes is that God, at the very least, had something to do with the production of the Hebrew Bible, even if the Bible is not verbally dictated by God or inerrant. Whether he inspired the Christians' New Testament or the Quran, the Muslims' Quran, is still an open question. And that places historic Judaism, by the way, on a decided advantage, because the burden of proof is now wholly upon either the Christian or the Muslim to provide evidence for what it is they believe. What remains to be proved? The answer is twofold. First, we must enter into the philosophical dispute going on between Abrahamic theists by establishing, as best we can, the true philosophy of theism and by answering all objections to it. And second, we must settle the dispute between the Jew, the Christian, and the Muslim concerning which religion is truly revealed by God. We follow this order because it seems obvious that the more confident a person is in theism's truth, the more open he will be to the truth claims of the various religions. Also, a knowledge of God gleaned from nature, a natural theology, may help us when assessing the revelation claims of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So philosophical theism, or natural theology, must precede religious theism, or revealed theology, in the order of presentation. Hence, in volumes 2 and 3 of this series, we will set forth a natural theology in order to, first of all, further vindicate Abrahamic theism. 2, the second thing we'll do is adjudicate the dispute between the various philosophical theologies. And 3, prepare the way for the establishment of the true religious expression of Abrahamic theism. Now, what method are we going to use in setting forth our case? In chapter 2, we demonstrated that the only way to establish the truth of a worldview is through incontrovertibleism. And we also pointed out that a worldview is true just in case it is transcendentally undeniable, or existentially undeniable, or analytically undeniable. As we have demonstrated throughout the volume, Abrahamic theism is undeniably true, for it is the only worldview that is transcendental. It alone gives us the preconditions for any kind of intelligible experience. But could alternative lines of reasoning, independent of the transcendental argument, be employed to establish the undeniability of theism? Can we press our standard of incontrovertibleism and thereby demonstrate that theism is analytically undeniable? Can we demonstrate that theism is existentially undeniable? We think we can show this, at least in a sense, and so we will do so in the next volume. Chapter 2 also made another important point. Namely, once an overall worldview is established, it is perfectly legitimate to adopt a combinationalist approach in order to establish the truth of a certain expression of that worldview. Now, what is combinationalism? Combinationalism is the view that a worldview is true just in case it is internally coherent and factually adequate. And the reason that's problematic if you're trying to judge between worldviews is because a worldview is the very thing that you use to assess what is factual. Okay? So to give you an example, you're talking to an atheist and you say, I have proof for you that God exists. And he says, what is it? And you say, Jesus rose from the dead. And the atheist says, what are you kidding me? You believe that Jesus rose from the dead? That's impossible. No, it's not impossible because, you know, we have all this evidence. Well, what evidence? You have evidence written in records by people that could barely read generations after the event supposedly happened. And this is why I don't even think Jesus existed. And so you get into this long debate with him. What's the problem going on here? He's looking at the evidence through the grid of his atheistic worldview. Right? Okay, well, let's say that you finally, after many months, twisted the atheist's arm through pure logic and proved to him that Jesus rose from the dead, which would be quite a monumental task. At that point, the atheist could say, wow, a man rose from the dead. You say, okay, so you're going to become a Christian, right? No, I'm not going to be a Christian. Atheism is still true. What are you kidding me? I just proved to you that Jesus rose from the dead. I know. Really weird things happen in our universe. Okay? So notice how facts are interpret facts. They are always mediated through the grid of a worldview. And so if you're arguing about a fact, that fact has to be judged by way of your worldview. So you can't really get at the facts if you're talking to someone who doesn't share your worldview. Weltanschauung was one long train of thought attempting to establish a certain philosophy of fact, a way of looking at facts, hence Abrahamic theism. So you can't use combinationalism. You can't say, if I have a worldview out there that is consistent and factually adequate and livable or whatever, you can't use that as a test between worldviews. However, having established the truth of Abrahamic theism, we're now going to take the combinationalist approach and look and see which expression of Abrahamic theism is true. You know, is it Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, or the Muslim view? Right? And that can be decided combinationally. In other words, because Muslims, Jews, and Christians look at facts in a similar enough way, you can actually use facts to try to show that your worldview or your religious expression of theism is far more probable than theirs is. Does that make sense? Okay. So even if an Abrahamic theist can only show that, say, open theism is only probably true with respect to the evidence, he has nevertheless demonstrated that all Abrahamic theists ought to adopt his philosophical expression of theism. In the same way, if one can use the test of systematic consistency to show that Islam is more probable, then all Abrahamic theists must become Muslims. If the evidence points you in that direction, that's where you should go. I don't think I have to say much more by way of this work, the epilogue. So my next question is, do y'all have any questions about this? Yeah. Wait. I have to hand you a microphone so we can have all this recorded.
So just to clarify, as we are comparing the different Abrahamic faiths here,
yeah.
There might be some who would look at Mormonism and see their references to Jesus or even their occasional acceptance of the traditional scriptures and wonder why they are included in that category.
My answer to your question is that Mormons are not Abrahamic theists. Mm-hmm. They are a polytheistic, heretical group within that tries to portray themselves as Abrahamic theists. And one of the things that we did in Weltanschauung is we pointed out that, Joseph Smith was a polytheist. He believed that God was a man like us who once existed, who now sits in yonder heavens as God. And so the Mormon has a worldview that is insufficient. And this is why a lot of your Mormon intellectuals are now becoming more pan-entheistic. They have to anchor their polytheism and something larger than those gods, because you don't have an ultimate explanation for how the universe got here if you're a Mormon. Can you do mind passing the microphone over?
Well, I was going to say, isn't their reliance on the Abrahamic tests in itself self-defeating for them, right? Or would
that exactly.
Or is the word insufficient? Because the fact that they are resting on texts from the Abrahamic faiths to therefore support their own worldview. So if they're using it's the text from another worldview. It's not necessarily another worldview. But if you're using the text from Abrahamic theism for your own worldview, would that not be an insufficient worldview?
Yeah, I think you're actually right. You can actually ramp up the critique of Mormonism by showing that it's not just insufficient as a worldview, but it is self-defeating, because they actually have an authority that says things like Psalm 90, verse 1, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Well, if God was once a man if God was once a man like us who now sits in yonder heavens, says Joseph Smith, then how can God from everlasting to everlasting be God? And they've had a very hard time with that. The most that a Mormon can do from the scriptures, and I'm talking about the absolute most, is to try to show that God, his essence, is somehow corporeal. Because we do have physical descriptions of God in the Bible. But he can't show that God was once a man like us, who now sits in yonder heavens, because the scriptures tell us that God is not a man, that he should lie or deceive Israel. So the Bible explicitly says that God is not a man. And so now the Mormon has to say, well, he's not a man now, but he used to be. Well, now we have all kinds of problems. When some Mormon missionaries came and visited me, and usually when they knock on my door, I let them in. Come on in. They at one point said to me, because I brought up this whole issue, and they said to me, well, he was once finite and he became infinite. Now, I would just suggest to all of you that that just is impossible. If you're finite, you're always finite. And if you're infinite, you're always infinite. At most, you can maybe be infinite and become finite. But you certainly cannot be finite and become infinite. Any other questions? All right, well, you'll notice the title for the next work we're getting into, and the title is The Resurrection of Natural Theology. The Resurrection of Natural Theology, and this is part one. The natural theology work is really going to take up two volumes. But the Resurrection of Natural Theology is part one, will cover ontological and cosmological arguments. Now, you might say, well, what is an ontological and cosmological argument? Well, you're going to learn how to analyze and defend this very kind of reasoning in the course of our work. So I'm not going to explain what those are. But I do want to give you the opening quote or the opening quotation. And this, Weltanschauung started with Immanuel Kant, Dare to Know. Well, I chose this one from Jonathan Edwards. Nothing is more certain, and I love this, nothing is more certain than that there must be an unmade and unlimited being. And one of the things that I hope you walk away with this, if you know nothing besides what I'm about to tell you, I hope you walk away from this study believing that it's easier to prove God's existence than your own existence. Your own existence is more doubtable than God's very existence, if that were even possible. So, without further ado, we're going to get into this. Here's the prologue, and by the way, I do have a, for this work, I have a table of contents also where it takes you through the chapters. Here's the prologue, and I point out that this is the second in a series called The Search for Truth. And I also point out here that in the previous volume, after showing that Abrahamic theism is the incontrovertible truth, we only arrived at a minimalistic version of Abrahamic theism. And so we left two lacunae in that work. What is the major religious expression of Abrahamic theism? And what is the most reasonable philosophical expression of Abrahamic theism? And so in this work, we're not going to take up what is the most plausible religious expression of Abrahamic theism. We're going to deal with the philosophy of theism for the next couple of months, however long this takes us. And so what I want to do is give you kind of a description of classical theism vis-a-vis neoclassical theism, vis-a-vis open theism, because that's really what we're going to talk about. Which philosophical expression of theism is more plausible? So down at the bottom of the page, I point out that classical theism has its roots in the first century Jewish philosopher Philo, along with the early church fathers, and came into prominence in St. Athanasius and St. Augustine, and still later in medieval scholastics such as Boethius and the Archbishop of Canterbury, St. Anselm, who is credited with giving us a perfect being theology. So one of the things that I want you to be before this class is over is Anselmian. I want to convert you to Anselmianism. Who is Anselm? He was the great individual, the great theologian, who gave us, among other things, the ontological argument for God's existence. And even if the argument is unsound, many theists have wanted to say his basic beliefs are true. God is the greatest conceivable being. The classical view of God reached its high point in the works of Averroes, Moses Maimonides, Bonaventure, Albert the Great, and his famous student Thomas Aquinas. And its basic presuppositions were then affirmed by Occam and Beale. Protestant reformers, especially Luther, Melanchthon, Zwingli, Farel, Bucer, Calvin, they all affirmed the classical view of God. And this model of theism has been championed in the modern and contemporary era by later reformed scholastics and evangelical theologians such as Beza, Vermigli, Zanke, Owen, Charnock, Turretin, and so forth. Some people on this list, I'm learning that I might have to take off And one in particular, I'm waiting for his second edition of his new book to see where he goes with some things. But that's basically the tradition. So you'll notice that the vast majority of Christian theologians have upheld a classical view of God. Also, most modern and contemporary Roman Catholic theologians, at least those that are conservative, are classical theists. They include people like Cayetan and Banez and Pascal and Newman, Chesterton, a favorite of mine, Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, John Henry Newman, Gilles Zone, Maritain. I could go on. In the Catholic tradition, the classical view of God is often called Thomism. For most Catholics who espouse this perspective either exist in the Dominican order or identify closely with the metaphysics of Thomas Aquinas. Among evangelical theologians, this view of God is often called the Reformed view of God, and sometimes you'll hear it be called Calvinist Thomism or Reformed Thomism, since most defenders of the perspective identify themselves with the Reformed tradition. Distinctives of the classical view of God include the following. God's existence is identical to his essence, for he is pure actuality with no potentiality, existing wholly a se and or independently of the world. He is metaphysically pure and simple, having no parts, passions, or accidental properties attached to his nature. He is timeless, spaceless, and wholly unchanging. And he is absolutely sovereign over all that he has created. As far as our knowledge of God is concerned, it is possible because there is, in some sense, an analogous relationship between God and humans who bear his image. To be sure, this school of thought is not wholly monolithic. Some of the theologians mentioned above would be uncomfortable putting these distinctives in such explicitly Thomistic terminology. But that said, such disagreements among classical theists are more often than not verbal rather than substantive. So that is the classical view of God. The neoclassical view of God is similar to the classical view, because most of the proponents of the perspective wish to preserve all that is coherent in the classical model of God. So, for example, neoclassical theists want to preserve Anselmian or perfect being theology, the sovereignty of God as well as his necessity, omnipotence, omniscience, omnibenevolence, and so forth. However, neoclassical thinkers believe that the classical view of God needs revision, since some doctrines of the classicists cannot overcome the charge of incoherence. Such doctrines include the following: God's pure actuality, his simplicity, his timelessness. Neoclassical theists think that these doctrines need to be either reformulated or rejected altogether. And if rejected altogether, neoclassicists are perfectly comfortable believing that God is omnitemporal, that is, he endures through time, is in some sense composed of parts. He's just a combination of his attributes, for example. And in some sense, he possesses some unfulfilled potential within his experience or within his being, and thus experiences intrinsic changes in his essence. Most neoclassical theists also feel the need to formulate a doctrine of divine sovereignty that will take into account the phenomenon of libertarian human freedom. And thus, many of these thinkers adopt some version of the doctrine of middle knowledge to reconcile divine foreknowledge and human free will. Now, I did a talk on middle knowledge for Sunday school that's available on the sermon audio site, and so I'm not going to get into that here, but I will simply say that middle knowledge is sort of the doctrine now that is espoused by neoclassical theists to reconcile libertarianism and divine sovereignty. I will also say that some people think that this is really just a rehashing of the old debate between the Calvinists and the Arminians. But one of the things that I want you to notice is that many of the people that I'm citing here are themselves Calvinists. There are neoclassical Calvinists. There are neoclassical Arminians. There are classical theists who are Arminians. There are classical theists who are Calvinists. So this is not the debate between the Calvinists and the Arminian here. Okay? Now, this view takes its inspiration from several church fathers, like Justin Martyr, as well as Anselm. Its greatest champions exist in the modern and contemporary world and include the following, both Roman Catholic and Evangelical Protestant: Luis de Molina, James Arminius, Francisco Suarez, John Wesley, Henry Tappan, John Miley. And I'm going to skip a few names and get to Alvin Plantinga. I would say that he is a neoclassical theist. Thomas Flint, Jonathan Kvanvig, John Feinberg, Frame. John Frame is a neoclassical theist. And he is Reformed. Terence Teason, Bruce Ware is a neoclassical theist. Ronald Nash, the now late and great Reformed philosopher, he is a neoclassical theist. Alan Paget, William Lane Craig, J.P. Moreland, these are all neoclassical theists. Like the classical theists, the neoclassical viewpoint is not wholly monolithic. For some of these thinkers reject a libertarian view of the will, Frame and Teason. Others reject mental knowledge, like Hunt and Nash, while still others wish to embrace the timelessness of God, like Arminius and Molina. That said, these thinkers all agree that the classical view of God needs an adjustment, and most contemporary neoclassicists wish to either revise or reject the classical theistic doctrines of simplicity, eternity, immutability, and so forth. All right. And then finally, we have our open view of God. What is the open view of God? It's sort of the new kid on the block. And really what the open view of God is the halfway house between the panentheist and the theist. The open view of God basically says that God is an intimately personal and relational being. He is a most moved mover. By the way, that's the title of a book by an open theist, The Most Moved Mover. Clark Pinnock, you know. Who wishes to enter into genuine give and take relationships with his creatures. He wants to receive something from the creature and wants to give to the creature as well. So he wants to have real give and take with his creatures. To be sure, God in eternity past had the free choice to set up things the way that the Thomistic, Calvinistic deity has done. And that's what distinguishes the open theist from the panentheist. In such a way that God would have absolute control and always gets his way, but he has chosen not to do this. So he's chosen not to be like that kind of deity. He wanted a world in which he himself would experience genuine disappointment and regret over the things that happen in creation. He wants to rejoice over those who flourish and do good, and he genuinely feels grief over those who suffer and do evil. The only kind of world in which God is able to experience those sorts of things is one in which God exists in time, and so changes both essentially and in the way he relates to his creatures. He lacks a complete foreknowledge of the future. He can't know the future totally. Again, God could have created a world in which everything is completely foreknown by him, but such a world would severely limit, if not destroy, the genuine freedom of the creature. So God chose to limit his own prescience, power, sovereignty, and so forth, in order to make room for his free creatures. And so the open view of God not only lacks an exhaustive foreknowledge of the future, he also lacks many of the classical and even neoclassical attributes of God, such as necessity, simplicity, immutability, eternity, and so forth. And I want to stop there and make sure you understand this. Why does the open view of God, why is the open God lacking in necessity? What does it mean to be necessary? Well, let me give you one definition. All right. I'm going to just draw three circles here. These circles represent logically possible worlds. Right? If God exists necessarily, then that means that it is a contradiction in terms to say that God does not exist. And so if God exists necessarily, then there is no logically possible world in which God is not. So God is here, 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 ad infinitum. You cannot conceive of a world in which there is no God. Let me give you another example of what a logical necessity would be like. The laws of logic are logically necessary by definition. Without the laws of logic, well, you couldn't think about a world, and a world couldn't be. A world couldn't be even conceptual or conceivable, right? So there's no logically possible world where the law of non-contradiction doesn't exist. Okay? And the law of non-contradiction is therefore necessary. It is a necessary truth. Does that make sense? God is the same. If God is necessary, then God is a necessary truth. God is logically necessary. Now, there are some theists who think they can prove that. There are other theists who don't think that you can prove that. However, that doesn't keep those theists who don't think they can prove that, that doesn't keep them from embracing the necessary existence of God, the idea that God exists necessarily. Does that make sense to all of you? Okay. If the open view of God is correct, why is God not necessary? Why is God not a necessary being if open theism is true? Well, let me go ahead and try to answer my own question then. God is not necessary if open theism is true because there are some worlds in which God lacks a property that he possesses in another. So, for example, according to open theism, one logically possible world is a world that is very much like the Calvinist world where God creates the universe out of nothing and foreordains everything that comes to pass and so on and so forth. God could have made such a world, and therefore God could have been sovereign in just the way Calvinists conceive. Again, that's what distinguishes the open view of God from panentheism. In panentheism, God could not have done such a thing because the world is eternal anyway. And so God can't create the universe out of nothing, right? So panentheism is outside the fray, if you will, of Abrahamic theism. But open theists could be Abrahamic theists. They at least want to appeal to the same authorities. And one of the things that makes them Abrahamic theists is they at least will grant that God could have made a world that's exactly what like what the Calvinists and the Thomists want. Y'all understand that? Now, so I can ask the open theist the following question. Could God lose his omnipotence? Well, God could have created a world in which he just says, I will give up my omnipotence for the sake of this world. Could God lose his omniscience altogether? Not only in the sense that he doesn't know the future, but doesn't even know present tense facts. Yes, God could have made a world in which he's ignorant of the present and even lacks a knowledge of some past events. Right? Could God create a world in which he is not omnipresent? Yes, he could create a world in which his essence is now eternally yoked to a physical form. And he's now spatially located somewhere in the cosmos and therefore is not omnipresent. Are y'all following me here? In other words, every single one of God's attributes or properties can be lost if the open view of God or if the open God chooses to lose them. Now, here's my question. Can you be a propertyless being? Can you exist with absolutely no attributes? I think you're right. You cannot exist with no attributes. If you absolutely have no attributes whatsoever, then you are not. Well, if every single one of God's attributes is contingent, in other words, if I can conceive of a world in which omniscience is not, and omnipotence is not, and omnipresence is not, then why can't I conceive of a world in which all of those properties are just gone in which case there is no God. And therefore, God is not logically necessary if open theism is true. Now, I want all of you to drink that in for just a minute. Think about what you may be giving up if you embrace the open view of God. And I'm going to stop right there and let you just mull on that, but think about what you might be giving up if you embrace open theism. I'll go on. There are still aspects of the classical view of God open theism wishes to preserve. For example, classical theists affirm the doctrine of creation out of nothing, and open theists have been known to insist upon this doctrine with great vigor. Open theists also insist upon the sovereignty of God. This may seem strange in light of what has already been said, but open theists see their view of God as in some sense even more sovereign than the classical view. For in the classical view, God is locked in a timeless realm, unable to enter into real relationships with his people. Nor can such a deity sovereignly change his mind as new situations arise. The open view of God is Lord of the possible, like a chess player who knows all of your logically possible moves before you make them. The open view of God can anticipate anything that might arise from his creation and react accordingly. He has sovereignly entered into the game of creation, and he plays for keeps. There is a... can I go ahead and finish this point, and then you can ask your question. This view of God, while fairly new, has its roots in the thought of Heraclitus, who emphasized change and fluidity over and against the immutabilism of Parmenides and Zeno, combined with an intensely literal reading of the Bible. For example, think of texts where God changes his mind and repents of his former actions. The flood story is a really common story. Or Moses prays to God and it says he changed his mind. What does that mean? Well, they take that very literally. You know, God apparently didn't know that Moses was going to pray, and he changed his mind and reacted to that. It's a major philosophical argument, and no one can be generally free if God knows all of his actions. It's first expressed by Aristotle, who, in his De Interpretatione, argued that the law of bivalence does not apply to future tense propositions. What is the law of bivalence? The law of bivalence is a concomitant of the law of excluded middle. Law of excluded middle says that between contradictions, there's no third alternative. So Travis Campbell is wearing a green shirt. Travis Campbell is not wearing a green shirt. Between those two alternatives, there's no third option, right? Okay. Well, if every proposition, if the law of excluded middle is true, it seems that every proposition is either going to be true or false. What is a proposition? It's a declarative statement about reality. And therefore, every proposition you utter is either corresponding to reality or it fails to correspond to reality. So far, so good? Well, that's the law of bivalence. The law of bivalence says every proposition is either true or false. And what the open theists do is they say, well, not every proposition is true or false. Future tense propositions are neither true nor false. Right? So if you have a prediction that a sea battle is going to take place tomorrow, that was Aristotle's example. Or if someone predicts that, say, tomorrow I'm going to have a cheese omelet for breakfast, because the future does not exist to be known, there is nothing to which a future tense proposition can correspond to. So the future, which is tomorrow, doesn't exist. And so when you say Travis Campbell will have a cheese omelet for breakfast tomorrow, there's no future to which that proposition corresponds. And therefore, the proposition is neither true nor false. And therefore, they deny the law of bivalence with respect to those kinds of propositions. Cicero's views on the divine cognition were similar, for he did not think it was possible for creatures to to be free if God's foreknowledge is exhaustive. By the way, Buddha had a similar argument in his sutras. You can find Buddhist arguments against an omniscient being for the same reason. It appears that the 5th century theologian Chalcedius affirmed many of the doctrines open theists now want to embrace. The modern world saw the first expression of open theism in Faustus Socinus, a 16th century thinker who denied the absolute foreknowledge of God and the innate awareness of the deity in all humans, though, unlike open theists, he also denied the Trinity. Open theistic views found sympathy in Henry Tappan and were embraced by Lorenzo McCabe and the popular circuit preacher Billy Hibbard. And the open view of God was also espoused in one form or another by such noteworthy theologians as Fechner, Federer, Lecour, as well as the great Bible commentary Adam Clark in the 19th century. Boyd goes on to give other names. Process theologians such as Alfred North Whitehead, Hartshorne Cobb, Griffin, and others are the most important modern philosophical influence upon open theists, since they also insist upon change, relationships, risk-taking, and so forth as important aspects of God's character. Karl Barth, by insisting that God is supremely free and who literally determines his own attributes, seems to have paved the way for the reception of open theism among evangelicals. And the following philosophers and theologians are either outspoken open theists or at least think of God along open view lines of thought. And I'm thinking of people like Pike and Swinburne and Kushner and Bassinger and his brother, Bassinger, Robert Brough and Sanders. And then the major ones are Richard Rice, William Hasker, Greg Boyd, and then the king of them all was Clark Pinnock, who passed away not long ago. The purpose of the next two volumes in our series is twofold. First, we wish to continue our critique of all non-theistic worldviews by providing positive evidence for Abrahamic theism. In this sense, all the views outlined above can appreciate our overall case for theism, even if there are points of disagreement in the details. And second, we wish to provide philosophical, scientific, and psychological evidence favoring the classical model of God. I'm a classical theist through and through. In fact, I don't think any of the other views really can stand a chance once you understand what the classical theists were arguing way back when. So you had a question.
So earlier when you made the reference to the open theistic view of God, where it says that he is Lord of the possible, like a chess player who knows all of your moves and before you make them. And it says he can anticipate anything that might arise from creation and react accordingly. Now, within that view, in that relationship between God and creation, if he is anticipating and reacting, then doesn't that mean that creation is actually, in that relationship, the one that takes the initiative? That it's more leading and God is following them?
I think the best I could do with that is to say that the open theist would want to say yes on some occasions. I mean, in other words, the creature can take initiative. And God himself can take initiative. They both can take initiative.
At which point, how is God sovereign if they're technically equals in terms of power over what is to come in the future?
Well, first of all, God has maintained enough power to overcome. So Can God determine your free will on some occasions if he really needs to? Well, yeah. I mean, an open theist would be open to that sort of thing. Pardon the pun. But they would say that God could, if there's an end that absolutely has to be accomplished, God can so determine the wills of the creature to make sure that that happens. Now, I think the next question to be asked is, first of all, how can you hold the creature responsible for his actions if God is doing that sort of thing? Because that seems to be even more Calvinistic than what Calvinists want to do. Calvinists have never wanted to say that God twists the will and coerces the will to do something. And since God is now in this world with us, working with us to make a better place, how is he doing this other than a kind of mechanical determinism that even the Calvinist wants to eschew? right? That's the first question. The second question is, you know that old little ditty, for want of a shoe, a horse was lost, and so on. So you have the guy, the horse trips, the saddle breaks, the rider falls off, and the battle is lost. Well, for want of, say, you know, one sperm making it to the egg, you might not make that person come into existence who needs to be a very important person to accomplish an end, right? Well, doesn't that start taking us down a certain road where God's allowing you to be genuinely free, quote unquote, is the exception rather than the rule? Because aren't things always going out of sync in our world? And isn't God always having to kind of come in and fix things up? See, on the classical model, God created the universe out of nothing, knowing all along what would happen, and thereby foreordained everything that comes to pass. And the word, the decree itself, is what kind of sustains this world in existence and lets it pass from moment to moment. And the creed determines that we all be free. But on the open view of God, it seems like God is going to have to get more involved than even the classical model is saying. And God is always having to go in and kind of fix things. So it's your point is well taken in the sense that it's a reactive God, and it seems like he has to react more than proact. And go ahead.
It would seem that he would have trouble guiding creation to a certain end as well. If he's constantly reacting to the creation, does he have a purpose or a plan that he's actually created all of these beings for?
Another good question, and it seems to me that if you follow this out consistently, God can't just have a plan A. He's got to have a plan B, C, D, and we run out of letters of the alphabet before it's over. Because he's always having to adjust his plan. Okay. Any other questions?
So Craig was a neoclassical.
Yeah, William Lane Craig would be a neoclassical theist. And he actually believes that God is intrinsically changing and that sort of thing. Anybody else? Are y'all ready to finally start studying? That's all prolegomena. That's all introduction. But I think it's important to sort of set our bearings and get going. And what I want to do is in the next 30 minutes or so, just kind of get our feet wet into natural theology. You have the chapter. When I did this with Nathan over the summer, I kind of gave him just a little bit at a time. But now I'm going to give you the whole chapters. And so I'd love it if you read what I have written and you take it home and you come back with more questions and that sort of thing. And we're looking for maybe getting a PDF of Velfon Chong and then this to put on the sermon audio site so people can download it. But let's look at the opening here. I point out that as little as 50 or 40 or even 30 years ago, a work like this one was rare, unexpected, and disrespected. The very fact or the very idea of going out and setting forth a natural theology was at one point just laughed at in the academy. The notion that the theistic God is a meaningful idea, let alone a coherent one, let alone a true one, let alone a provable one, was ridiculed in the academy, and the first half of the 20th century may be looked upon as the glory days of atheism. The first half of the 20th century gives us Marxism. And so by the 1950s, Marxism had established itself as arguably the most powerful political force in the modern world. The majority of scientists were absolutely convinced that they were on the threshold of unlocking the mystery of life's origins. The steady state model of the universe, one that advocated in the eternally existing cosmos, was gaining ground as very respectable among cosmologists and astrophysicists. Logical positivism had established that the word God was wholly without cognitive meaning. That's a very important point, by the way. They're not saying that God is just illogical, but God doesn't even mean anything. God doesn't even have the dignity of being an illogical contradiction. That would be giving him too much credit. The Holocaust of World War II left many wondering if it is still feasible to speak of God as an absolute sovereign who cares for his creatures. Where was he when 6 million Jews were gassed and millions upon millions died fighting the Nazis? By the time we reached the 60s, even theologians were getting in on the act. For example, Paul Tillich had already written in Systematic Theology where he argued that the word God was just a symbol of the ever-ambiguous ground of being. Thomas Altizer of Emory University went on to advocate Christian atheism, which postulated that the myth of God is now dead. My father actually studied under Altizer. That's just a biographical point I wanted y'all to know. It doesn't really prove anything either way. The April 8th issue in 1966 of Time magazine ran our lead story, for which the cover was completely black, all except for bright and red letters which read, "Is God dead?" I don't know if y'all remember that. I don't, because I was in the 60s. So you remember that cover of Time magazine, "Is God dead?" That was then, and this is now. One of the problems with Weltanschauung is I don't even really try to help you catch up with what's going on in the contemporary scene. I try to make things look bleak for the theist. Because what I'm trying to show is that even on his worst day, theism wins. But now, as I'm saying these words, we're living in a new golden age of